Hello, this is the HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and I'm joined by HSJ correspondents Jo Talora and Emily Townsend. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing the ongoing crisis in A&E, not in terms of corridor care or long trolley waits, but instead the high attendances of mental health patients, often accompanied by police officers under Section 136 of the Mental Health Act. We'll be getting into the debate about who's responsible for this, how it should be solved, and then some more on what mental health leaders are calling for in terms of funding. Also, Jo will be taking us through the first ever snapshot into how digitally savvy integrated care systems are. We'll discuss the findings and how meaningful they are. But first, let's start with mental health patients in A&E departments. And we're talking about it this week because of a story that you wrote, Emily, which reported comments from a non-executive director of a big acute London hospital and also a former NHS Improvement medical director, Cathy McLean. And her comments have prompted quite a debate below the line in your story. And perhaps we could start with what she said.
Yeah, so Cathy McLean's a non-executive director at Barking, obviously a huge trust with major A&E problems. So essentially at a board meeting, she expressed her shock at seeing going to A&E and seeing basically loads of mental health patients accompanied by police officers. She said that obviously as part of her past role as an NHS Improvement medical director, she's visited lots of A&Es across the country. She was saying that she was really shocked at the sight of King George Hospital's ED, where essentially she said everywhere you looked, there was a police officer. She then said this needs an absolute solution. And she was also saying about the neighbouring mental health trusts in the system, East London Foundation Trust and North East London Foundation Trust, essentially sparked quite a debate because she was saying about, this is not our problem, it's their problem. And hence there was lots of kind of debate about her comments, because in the era of ICSs, it's meant to be about kind of collective responsibility and trying to work together to reach a solution. So yeah, essentially there's a problem with Section 136 referrals in London in particular, but it isn't a problem across the country. Essentially, Section 136 is where police will detain somebody under Section 136 of the Mental Health Act and take a mental health patient to a place of safety. Normally, that's a hospital. It's not meant to be an A&E department. It's normally meant to be to a mental health trust, but obviously there are, particularly in North East London and also across the country, there's an acute shortage of inpatient mental health beds. So therefore, police officers end up in A&E sitting with mental health patients, and hence what Cathy saw and sparked concern over.
But this isn't a new problem. This is something that has been an issue for a while, do you think?
Yeah, it's been a problem for a long time, and it's been a debate over who is responsible for it for a long time. However, it has reached, I think, awareness of Section 136, and we've had lots of debates about, obviously, the Metropolitan Police said earlier this year they gave an ultimatum to NHS England and social care partners that essentially they were going to withdraw from most mental health calls because of the fact that their officers were spending, record amounts of time with mental health patients and A&Es, and they were saying that was taking up a lot of their resources and, restricting their ability to respond to other calls. And I think there has been a lot more awareness of it. We also, when we went to the integrated care system and to the two mental health trusts, the response we got back was that essentially they've seen a significant rise in presentations. So Matthew Trainer, who's the CEO of Barking, was saying that it's their third consecutive record month for referrals. So obviously it's getting worse, the problem. But they also said, interestingly, that a rising number of presentations are appearing to result from social pressures. So obviously you've got cost of living, you've got lots of issues with debt, and in particular in North East London, you've got a very deprived area of the capital. So not only have you got kind of an acute problem with Section 136 in the capital because of the nature of it, because it's a big city and there are lots of issues, but you also have, you know, one of the most deprived areas of London, and a very big NHS trust that has had repeated problems not only with physical health patients but also mental health patients. So essentially I saw this as you know, Cathy essentially trying to say, look, this is a massive problem that needs a solution, but the controversy was sparked from the responsibility debate.
And are there any national initiatives to deal with this problem? Is it something that the national team are aware of? Have they tried to do anything to make it better for both mental health trusts and acute trusts?
So in terms of national help, I think the bed problem is one of the biggest contributors to this issue. So in his comments, Matthew Traynor, when he was talking at the board meeting, he was saying that at the time of the board meeting, there were 28 patients waiting for a mental health bed. So essentially you have police officers bringing people to a place of safety because they cannot access an inpatient mental health bed or other community services. And there has been obviously quite a big initiative for national policy over the last few years, where it's been very much a focus on expanding community services, investing in community services and trying to make those better and to reduce the need for an inpatient admission. However, there are still numbers of people, lots of people, particularly from the pandemic and acuity of illness, that do need an inpatient mental health bed. And that's where you have, that's where, you know, that's the kind of section of people that are presenting to A&Es and are under accompaniment from police officers. In terms of kind of regional initiatives, so obviously London has been seen to have a particularly acute problem. There was a story that was put out by the Evening Standard earlier this week, which essentially we reported on earlier in the year after the Met Police's kind of ultimatum, where essentially they said that there are various initiatives going on to try and reduce the number of Section 136 presentations. Essentially, this is kind of a new hub where mental health professionals will be able to police officers will be able to consult mental health professionals for advice, but it's not, this is happening all the time anyway, but this is basically meant to be like a bespoke service that will allow police officers almost like a direct line. But it's, that is something that happens anyway. It's not necessarily that new, but it is something that they're trying to bring in to try and reduce the number specifically. However, the problem will be made a lot worse if there is this ultimatum that comes in and police officers do start to refuse to attend calls. That will make it a lot worse. So there are national initiatives, there's not necessarily like a big kind of drive nationally to reduce Section 136. There are regional reactions that are kind of coming out as a result of London's specific problem, but you also have, as I mentioned, the kind of national policy shift towards kind of more community-based care. But clearly community-based care is not assisting in this problem at the moment, because there are record numbers presenting to A&E.
With the hub that you mentioned there, that the police could contact a mental health professional, is there any sort of worries about capacity there? Are these professionals available to be answering calls from the police?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, there are a limited number of mental health professionals that people can contact. And, you know, that's one of the main concerns, really, is that are the staff actually going to be available to give this advice? And are police actually going to have the time to be able to do that? Because obviously it's a very reactive situation. Are they going to be able to get hold of somebody? And I think that's one of the biggest fears of people, is that actually, like, as much as it's being talked about as a solution, is it actually going to be an effective solution, or is it just going to kind of make the situation not worse, but it's just going to exacerbate the fact that there's not much workforce to support it, really?
And I think, Emily, you said that part of the solution here is about creating more beds in the capital. You also interviewed Adrian James from the Royal College of Psychiatrists, who's the departing president. So it's a bit of an exit interview. And obviously you touched on some of their asks, including lack of beds. But it would be interesting to hear what he said in terms of what they would like from the government, what they feel is lacking, and kind of, I suppose, the future of mental health funding. We're just coming to the end of the mental health long-term plan funding, I think, early next year.
Yeah, so he was talking, there's been kind of quite a big narrative nationally, as I said, about shift towards community services, but I think there are leaders kind of standing up and saying a little bit more frequently now. And obviously Adrian James in his exit interview, and Dr. Lade Smith, who is going to become the new president of Royal College of Psychiatrists. And essentially it is actually people coming out and saying, look, actually there aren't enough beds, and there are some people who do reach the threshold for needing a bed, and in some cases it is the most therapeutic intervention for them, but there aren't enough available. And it's starting to shift now. It's being recognised that although in an ideal world community services would be brilliant and well staffed and funded, at the moment that's not the reality. And obviously the funding for the NHS long-term plan is coming to an end in 23-24. We've had quite a few targets that haven't been met, including, see, they were meant to eliminate out of area placements by 2021. It's now been 2 years since that target, more than 2 years, and that's just not happened. So you have lots of worries, I think, as we go into 23-24 and the end of the funding for the plan, because there is a concern that community transformation hasn't happened at the rate that it should have. And you have lots of people at the acute end who are presenting to A&Es, and there's lots of pressure there. And for, to be honest, at a kind of human level, you have lots of people who are in acute crisis, who are in cubicles in A&Es for several days, as we reported earlier, sometimes even a month, and a lot of the time you have professionals kind of arguing over whose responsibility it is. Obviously that's something that's been argued about in the Catherine McLean piece, so it's very much a concern, I think, and people are starting to say actually people do need inpatient mental health beds when they get to a point where they their illness is very acute and particularly bad, and community services are not effective enough at the moment. Mm-hmm. Although it's a long-term ambition, it's not effective at the moment. He was also saying a little bit about funding, and kind of saying that actually in terms of parity of esteem, particularly in terms of funding, although there has been a growth in the proportion of funding allocated to mental health in the NHS over the last few years, it's not been enough. And essentially lots of the, when we had the COVID recovery plan, and there was lots of money announced for acute services, mental health just wasn't, it didn't get a look in. And I think that's a real concern among sector leaders, is that mental health share of the cash still isn't enough. And if we want to close the gap, if we want to close the access gap and also reduce waiting lists, they need to be prioritised to the same degree.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned community services. That seems to me like an area to really invest in. And I know that Labour have talked about this a bit in terms of their pledges for the NHS if they were to win the next election. But do you think that would be enough, kind of investing more in community services to provide care closer to home, hopefully preventing people from getting to the point where they're turning up at A&E, in a very sort of serious state, being stuck in A&E for a long time? Or is it kind of about both, I suppose, more inpatient beds and also better support in the community?
Yeah, so there's an initiative at the moment that's going on that the National Clinical Director is looking at, which is essentially looking at how many beds we have and whether there needs to be an expansion, even though there's been this national policy. And I think there has been targeted investment into community services, but there has been an interesting thing that Adrian James was talking about when I spoke to him, was that there has been, this investment into community services. However, the demand for mental health services has gone up significantly, particularly during the pandemic, when elective services kind of closed down, mental health services were continuing. There's lots of problems with eating disorders in particular. He said that demand for those services skyrocketed. And when you've got particular demand, you're trying to expand services from a low point. You're trying to expand them from the 2019 long-term plan when it started. So from there to where we are now, the demand is just so much higher. You've got so many more people on waiting lists. And I think there has been this investment, and I think there has been progress, but it's just not been quick enough. And it has the bed base is not enough for the need right now. And I think the longer you have people on waiting lists, you've got 1.4 million people waiting for mental health services at the moment, the longer people are on those lists, the worse they will the deteriorate, and you know, you'll then have them escalating into mental health crisis. I'll just say one more thing just about that. This is sort of on the learning disability and autism services. We reported earlier this week about a 10-year wait for ADHD diagnosis services, and when we spoke to the charity ADHD wow. UK, they were saying that that was in Herefordshire and Worcestershire, but we know that average waits across like nationally are really bad. You know, that they're not where they should be, at least. So sort of average between 13 months and 18 months. And if that was physical health, you know, we've got targets for electives and 2-year waits. Everybody's kind of really, it's a big scandal, and it should be. But 10 years for somebody who is on an ADHD waiting list. And the charity's founder said to us that essentially you've got people who have ADHD, 1 in 4 women are likely to make an attempt on their life while they're on the waiting list. So it's really kind of acute problem. And I think there's just a concern that community services aren't being expanded at the rate they should be. The demand has really exacerbated the problem, and there just needs to be more government focus on really closing that gap.
That's really shocking. I'm sure we'll talk in more detail about that again in a future podcast, but I just before we move on to the next topic, I just wanted to very briefly circle back to the comments, Cathy McLean's comments about barking. Do you think, although controversial, she's made it a talking point, do you think it actually might prompt the trusts in North East London coming together and talking about this problem, or do you think it might have actually caused just disagreement and they're just going to be really grumpy at each other and maybe not solve anything?
I think it was her making a point because it has been a problem for a while, and I think there's been lots of discussion about it, but it hasn't necessarily hit the higher levels. And I do think the Integrated Care Board, this is kind of a bit of a warning shot to them, saying, look, you know, this is a real problem. But I don't think it necessarily helped kind of singling out the Mental Health Trust, because obviously they have, you know, they didn't respond directly, but the Integrated Care Board was saying, look, there is this pressure, we recognize it, we are trying, but there is a big problem. One of the interesting things actually that they said was that they are addressing kind of the high number of Section 136 presentations by directing patients to another hospital, which I believe is also run by Barking and Goodmayes. And, you know, that's kind of shifting the problem just onto another hospital. So I think while they are really trying, I think this particular discussion point has accelerated it and hopefully highlighted it to the Integrated Care Board. And, you know, I think one thing that Cathy said was that if this was ambulances queuing outside A&Es, then it would cause national outrage. But it's just something that people just accept for mental health patients, because, you know, they are not seen with the same value and the same kind of appreciation of their problems. So I think it was her putting her head above a parapet and saying, look, this isn't good enough. Matthew Train has obviously done the same thing for a long time, but having someone to Cathy's kind of, well, nothing saying this Train is obviously very experienced to say, but I think
her national role
elevates it a little bit. So
yeah, agreed. Thanks very much, Emily. Let's move on to digital maturity and bringing in you, Joe. I'm going to have to start with asking you to explain to me what are we talking about when we're referring to digital maturity? I can barely say it.
So essentially, it's just a snapshot of where organisations within the NHS are in terms of their digital capabilities. So it's been quite a big focus for NHS England since the pandemic, when, you know, we became a lot more reliant on data and on digital technology. It's become sort of key focus to make sure that all organisations reach a baseline level of digital maturity by 2025 is the goal. So that includes things like the systems that they use, electronic patient records, things like that. But then sort of further down the line, it's about empowering citizens by, you know, letting them book their own appointments online and have access to the records and things like that.
So, Joe, could you take us through what was found in this assessment of ICS's digital maturity?
Yeah, so interesting. This is the first time the integrated care systems have been sort of ranked based on their digital maturity. They only came into existence last year. So essentially, it's a pretty middling picture across the board. So the ratings go from 1 to 5, and on average, the NHS was rated as a 2.4, so almost smack bang in the middle. So there were three organisations that kind of stood out in terms of having higher scores. Frimley scored a 3.1, as did Suffolk and North East Essex, and then West Yorkshire scored a 3. So those were sort of the higher performing organisations. And then at the bottom, we had Northamptonshire, which scored a 2.2. So not a massive amount of variation between them. I suppose the sort of pattern that emerged was a lot of ICSs in the west and southwest of England scored fairly low, sort of 2.3, 2.4. And it was just interesting that the sort of ICSs that neighboured each other, quite large rural populations, seemed to have a lot of the same problems. And that was reflected in the digital maturity scores.
So it'd be quite interesting to talk about how these scores came about. As I understand it, it was done via a form of self-assessment, or actually no previous attempts for a self-assessment, but this was slightly different. I wonder if you could take us through this, because it's actually quite interesting.
Yeah, of course. So the last time that organisations in the NHS were ranked on digital maturity was 2019. So back then it was a very simple self-assessment questionnaire. Back in 2021, HSJ interviewed Matthew Gold, who's CEO of NHSX at the time, and he essentially said that they needed to change the way they assessed digital maturity because organisations were gaming the system, I think is what he said. So organisations were deliberately assessing themselves as lower than they actually were in order to get a bigger, you know, slice of funding. So this time round, NHS England awarded a contract to McKinsey worth about £6.7 million, or up to £6.7 million. And they were asked to devise and carry out this assessment. So there was still an element of self-assessment involved. So trusts and ICBs were sent a questionnaire. It's about 50 questions where they're asked to assess their different capabilities from 1 to 5. And it's all based on the what good looks like framework. So this was something published in 2021. This is now how NHS England measures digital maturity. So there's seven measures. So you've got well-led, smart foundations, safe practice, support people, empower citizens, improve care, healthy populations. And that's what they've identified as the sort of key facets of digital maturity and what they're aiming to achieve through digital maturity. So there's 50 questions. They're also then sent a contextual survey, which is about 100 questions. So that was a little bit more up for debate, I guess. It was just asking them specifically about individual systems. Mm-hmm. And then to avoid this sort of gaming the system, there's quite a high element of peer review. So organizations took a look at other organizations' scores and sort of discussed them. There were sort of preliminary scores were issued back in April, I think, and then over the summer meetings took place locally, regionally and nationally, and these peer reviews took place. And from what I've been told, not a lot changed, but it was just a way of ensuring that no one was, you know, deliberately assessing themselves as sort of higher or lower than they actually were.
So do you think that money was well spent? Do you think these scores are meaningful?
£6.7 million might be seen as a bit high to sort of carry out a couple of assessments. Especially
I know in NHS land it's not very much, but you know, it's still a sizable sum.
Yeah, I mean, it right now it might not seem too significant, especially since it seems like there's quite a lot of caution in how these questions were answered. You know, everyone scored kind of in the middle. I don't think anyone was too keen to, you know, stand out as really good or really bad. I think we'll really see the effect of this down the line. So this is the first step in a process. So NHS England told me that this is something that's going to be updated annually, and this is how decisions are going to be made about allocating resources and funding, and essentially just seeing where different organisations are at on their sort of digital maturity journey. And I should say as well that it was the providers who are asked all these questions, and as were ICBs. The ICS scores were an average of all of their provider organisations. So it kind of just gave a snapshot. So obviously smaller ICSs with fewer organisations might have benefited them, or it might have been a hindrance depending on how those organisations are doing.
I can imagine some providers. Oh, sorry, you go, Emily.
Yeah, I was just going to say, was there anything about, I know it's about digital maturity, but was there anything about kind of ability to respond to cyber attacks, that kind of thing? Because obviously that's sort of a big threat, I would imagine. And it was the impact, there was a big one for mental health providers last year. but I don't know whether that's something that factored into any of the decisions.
Yeah, so that's kind of factored into the score. So the seven measures. So I think things like safe practice and well-led. So well-led includes, you know, having people responsible for digital and cybersecurity on the board or at an organization. And then safe practice includes things like having a cybersecurity strategy and being able to respond. So those were factored into the overall scores. And again, not much variation in terms of those things. I think in terms of the measures, the one that's probably most important is the smart foundations, because that refers to what they can actually do now, what capabilities they have. So things like the maturity of their electronic patient records, their patient administration systems, and also things like their data and analytics capabilities. And the smart foundation scores pretty much tracked exactly with the overall scores. So the organizations that perform poorest in terms of smart foundations also tended to perform poorest overall. Interestingly, it was the empower citizens measure that no organization did very well on. So that's more things like giving patients digital access to their records, allowing them to book appointments digitally. No one really did very well on that. So that's clearly an area where there needs to be a bit of improvement. But going back to what you were saying about cybersecurity, that was definitely sort of a key aspect of the assessment.
So I was wondering about consequences, Joe. If an ICS hasn't scored very well, so they're a real outlier, what happens to them?
Yeah, so I think it's important to stress this wasn't designed to be, you know, a league table to name and shame. I guess that's kind of on me for doing that. This is supposed to be an internal report, just so that ICSs and organisations can see where they are and see where their neighbours are at. So I guess the consequences, somewhere like Northamptonshire, which scored quite poorly, it might just mean that there's more focus put on them in terms of what help they might need to reach that baseline of digital maturity. And as I said, they've been given a date of 2025 to sort of reach a good level, have the shared care record in place, have a good EPR in place. So there's still time to do this. And I think we might start seeing more consequences if things get worse or don't change much in a year's time, 2 years' time. I think right now it was just about seeing where people are at as a starting point.
Yeah, and I'm guessing this is going to continue, this assessment, this investigation into how they're doing in terms of all these different metrics. Is there going to be another one next year, do you expect?
Yes. So NHSE have told me that this will be an annual thing. So I guess maybe McKinsey will be given a contract again, or someone else will be given the contract to do this again next year. Organizations will be able to track this on a dashboard and see their progress against previous years. And I guess that's when we'll really start to glean some insight into this.
All right, thanks very much for taking us through that, Joe. I think it's a good point to wrap up the podcast this week. But just a reminder for listeners, we're available every week on our website and wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you haven't subscribed, please do. And also get in touch if you've got any questions for our team. Thanks for listening, and do join us again for the next one.